From the Sky News Centre at 5. Actor Jude Law's the latest celebrity expected to launch legal proceedings against the News of the World over claims his phone was hacked. That's as a High Court judge has held unprecedented meetings to decide how multiple cases should proceed. He's ruled 4 or 5 lead cases should be heard first to decide how the rest of the claims should continue. Media lawyer Charlotte Harris believes that's wise.
It may be that the only way to find out what truly happened will be through a trial, via cross-examination, witness statements, further disclosure. We're certainly not getting it now.
Scotland Yard is considering whether to begin a criminal investigation into allegations police were paid by newspapers for information. The claim was made by the former editor of the News of the World, Rebecca Brooks, in 2003. David Cameron's facing demands for a recall of Parliament amid claims Britain's now pursuing an overt policy of regime change in Libya. Senior Conservative and Labour MPs say the government's gone beyond the mandate given in last month's Commons vote to protect civilians. Disruptions expected this weekend after a fire in a scrapyard caused the closure of part of the M1 and delays to rail services. Football fans heading to the FA Cup semi-final between Manchester United and Manchester City may suffer. The hotel where Kate Middleton will spend her last night as a single woman has been lavish with a £150,000 upgrade. She'll stay at Belgravia's Goring Hotel ahead of her wedding 2 weeks today. Jeremy Goring's the hotel's chief executive.
We are delighted that we're able to play a small part in what's going to be a wonderful day of celebration around Britain. I know that we have a reputation for great service here and brilliant food, but I think primarily the Goring is a hotel that makes people feel at home.
And former EastEnder Michelle Collins is crossing over the divide to take on one of the biggest jobs in Soapland. The actress who played Cindy Beale is going to be the new landlady of the Rover's Return in Coronation Street. That's the latest.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and on the week, the Royal College of Nursing voted almost unanimously that Andrew Lansley's not fit for purpose. We ask, is the NHS a privatisation too far? Plus, immigration. Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron said this week that cheap foreign labour is not causing unemployment. But is it true? I'm joined this week by Conservative Councillor for Stoke Bishop, Peter Abraham, and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. After the 6 o'clock news, the nuclear power industry should be renamed the cancer industry. So says paediatrician Helen Caldicott in her talk at Eastern Community Centre last night. While radiation continues pouring out of Japan's stricken Fukushima Daiichi plant and all fishing is halted, the sea now tens of millions of times over the safety limit. Well, some people say money is a drug, and that may not be the only drug some of the top banking dynasties are hooked on. We look at how one may have become so powerful it controls news and business data companies, and it keeps its own name off the rich lists. Plus, the General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists for the last 10 years is leaving. We hear Jeremy Deer's tub-thumping final speech to conference, the rarely heard journalist's eye view of Britain's media. That's in the second hour after six. On to our review of this week's news in a minute. First, our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs, temperatures rising a little up to 16 degrees Celsius. Sunny on Saturday, a little wet though on Sunday. Next week, highs staying reasonably high at 17 Celsius, a fairly dry and sunny week. Next weekend, Easter weekend that is, already 23rd and 24th of April, highs 21 degrees Celsius, sunny and dry. That looks like a lovely weekend, doesn't it? And the bank holiday Monday, though, will be wet. Now, that was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Now, with me is Conservative Councillor for Stoke Bishop, Peter Abraham. Hi, Peter, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, first of all, you're as a Conservative politician in the city. What first got you into politics, Peter?
It's so long ago, quite frankly, I hardly remember. It was I was first elected to the City Council in 1966, which a lot of people weren't born then. So it is a long time ago. It actually was education. and the closure of grammar schools that I thought was a retrograde step, and I started to get active at that time.
So why was it the Conservatives that pulled you in rather than one of the other parties? I suppose in those days it would have been the Liberals rather than Lib Dems.
No. It would have been the Liberals, but they were hardly there at all. It would have been the alternative would have been the Labour Party, who of course were closing the grammar schools. So that was what why I joined the Conservatives.
Okay, now what about your role in the Conservative group on Bristol City Council? What roles have you had over the years? Because that's a while to be a councillor.
It is. I've had most, I think. I don't think there's many jobs I haven't done. I'm deputy leader at the moment. I was leader for a very long time, and who knows, I might be leader in a couple of weeks again, so I don't know.
What about your role outside the council? Have you got a full-time job as well as the other stuff you do? Are you retired?
For goodness sake, I'm 72 next month. How long are you going to keep me working? No, I did work until a couple of years ago, but now I'm pretty full-time. I do some national work for improvement in local government, and I go around the country assisting other local authorities. Until their demise, I was doing quite a bit with the Audit Commission, and I'm now doing some work with the Improvement and Development Group within the LGA.
So the LGA is the Local Government Association.
Correct.
What about committees on our council here? What do you sit on?
I'm chairman of planning for the north of the city, and I've just finished chairing the meeting of Bristol's Preservation Trust, which I'm a director of, chairman of the board. I'm chairman of the board of the Fire Control for the South West, and I'm a member of the Avon Fire Authority, and many more committees than I wish to remember. It's difficult attending them all.
Now, that chairing the Fire Control for the South West, quite a biggie, isn't it? Because that's a big area you're covering there.
It is.
And there's also this big dispute about whether there should be this one place down in Taunton to run all the fire control centres.
Well, I'm actually winding it up at the moment, because the Coalition have said that we shouldn't go ahead. So
how did it happen in the first place? Because it seems like a retrograde step. If you've got local people who know the local area, when you dial 999 for the fire brigade, it's much better to have someone that actually knows vaguely anyway the area you're talking about. So how on earth did it come?
You must ask John Prescott. It was one of his very, very silly, vindictive moves against the fire brigade after the strike, which upset him. It was foolish. We in Avon opposed it all the way through. But I did think that if it was going to happen, and Avon Fire Authority thought that if it was going to happen, we wanted to make the best throw, because so many millions have been wasted. But it was a political peccadillo, really, that's gone horribly wrong.
Now, we're also hearing that there's the potential cuts anyway in our fire service. So what's the latest state of play with the areas in which you're involved? Because I think this is something everyone's really worried about.
Well, first and foremost, I think that we've looked at how we can make the reductions, and we can without affecting in any way frontline services. The fire chief, for instance, is going to take a pay cut, which is a voluntary one, which I think he's to be congratulated on, because it is leading from the front. I don't think you will see appreciable differences in the fire service. I'm sure they'll be there. They'll be there for fires. They'll be there for rescues. What we have to do is do our job more efficiently, and that is what is giving our attention to.
And what do you think overall from the Conservative group as their spokesperson? What is the Conservative view and vision for Bristol?
I think our vision is that we want to see a city that's happy. This week we tended to talk about happy things, and I don't think we use these words enough. If people are contented and happy, then they're going to enjoy their city. I want a city that we're proud to say, I come from Bristol. I always have, and I always will be, but I think we've got to encourage others. I think we need desperately to look at how transparent we are. I think we're dealing with an electorate that's much more informed, much more intelligent than we did in the past. And I'm sure we're not telling them enough. We're not involving them enough. The issues on schooling has brought that to a head only recently. So I want a city that informs people, and a city that reaches out. We must have a look at traffic. That's another thing. But I don't think that can be done by banning cars. I'm not into banning. What I'm trying to do is really have an effective bus service. I know that many of my friends, and I will, use public transport when it is there, when it's efficient, it's clean, it's good, and at a cost I can afford. I think the price sometimes is prohibitive for families to go out. So I think we've got to look at that. I believe that we can do all these things if we concentrated on the main areas of our responsibility. I think one of the things, when I look around the offices of the City Council, we seem to have offices for everything. Perhaps we should have offices for just a few things that we do really well and are important.
Now, you talk about the buses there, but actually this is a Conservative policy, isn't it, the privatisation of the buses, and many people point to that as the specific reason why First Bus have a monopoly now, almost a monopoly anyway, and why the service is degraded, because the shareholders are taking a slice of every bus fare, aren't they?
Aren't they doing that in Manchester, Liverpool, Birmingham, London, where I seem to be able to use public transport in the way that I can't in Bristol? I don't accept that argument. Because something's privatised, it doesn't mean to say that it can't receive some state help, or that it can't have a profitable end to it that is effective and efficient. What we seem to have done is, because we had a bad bus service, put more and more people into the cars. That's why we've got the highest car ownership in the country here in Bristol, because we force people out of the bus into their cars. I think we've got to change that culture.
But under the old system, you know, the sort of nationalised system, actually it was Bristol Corporation buses, and you could actually, as councillors and as politicians, manage the buses almost directly. Now it's at arm's length.
But it was then that they got so bad that people packed it in. Those are the days when I did actually have to use the bus because I didn't have a car, and I was very, very lucky to get home before 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night, leaving work at 5:30 in the centre of the city. It was terrible. Bristol City Council at that time, and I don't think they could today, run the buses. It's not our job. Let's have professionals, but we've got to have a different culture of how we subsidise them and how we look at them.
Now, you talked about Bristol being a happy city. You want people to be happy, but you know, surely it's very difficult to be happy when you can see some of the most vulnerable around you in society, for example, losing their slices of their housing benefit, being told that they may be evicted from their homes, and also, of course, losing their jobs if they're in the, particularly in the public sector.
Well, if you look at the figures, of course, we are faring much better than the rest of the country on the jobs front. That's a fact, not just hearsay. I still believe that what we're going through at the moment is a necessary for the problems that we as a nation got into, and therefore I think there has to be some cure for that. But I don't think that stops people trying, and I am not convinced that having just carrying on the welfare state willy-nilly, paying more and more to stop people going to work because they can't afford to go to work because they're going to get paid less than the state pays them, that's not a way forward. So I think we've got to think again differently. We've got to be proactive, and I think that means targeting benefits to people who really need them and doing all we can in training to get people into work. The fact of the matter is, the people who cannot find jobs in Bristol, statistically at the moment, are those without qualifications. Now, that is our problem, and we need to address that and make sure that we do bring people up to speed so they're qualified to do the job.
Isn't it even more of a problem, actually, that there are only maybe a page and a half a week of jobs now in the Evening Post? The amount, it used to be quite a thick supplement you get every week in Wednesday's Evening Post full of jobs. Now it's down to about a page and a half a week.
But there's still jobs there.
Now, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is with me too. Hi, Martin. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello there.
This week, I'd like you to comment on this meeting that's been going on in China, which is the idea is that they are fed up with the West and a lot of what we're doing over here with our money system. I suppose this is the Bretton Woods system, really, the IMF and the World Bank and the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, etc. And they've set up something called BRICS, B-R-I-C-S, as an alternative to the money system that we're dealing with, which is basically a UK, European and US system. So what do you make of this meeting that's been taking place over in China?
It's not just the Chinese. The Chinese are hosting it, obviously, but the BRICS means Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa. South Africa have been invited to join it. I mean, the term BRICS was originally put together by a guy from Goldman Sachs, a hedge fund type person, and it was to describe these countries. They're not third world countries, but they're not developed countries. But of course, they become, you know, between them, they're a substantial chunk of the world economy now. Brazil, Russia, India, China. We'll leave South Africa aside.
Well, it says that they're now worth together about $12 trillion, compared with $15 trillion for the U.S. economy.
Yeah. So they get, well, they're getting bigger all the time, or they have been until recent years. They're fed up with using the dollar as a reserve currency. The dollar as a reserve currency allows the United States basically to run deficits, which other countries would not be able to do. The dollar was taken off gold in 1972 as a means of fighting the Vietnam War. The Americans were going to lose the Vietnam War, or felt they were going to lose it. They needed to carry on spending money, but they didn't want to actually raise taxes to fight the war, as they'd done in the Korean War. Top rate of tax in Britain and the US during the Korean War was 96%. Those were the days when the wealthy had to pay for their own wars.
Well, in one of the first concrete steps, we're told in this article from the Washington Post, is one of the first concrete steps, the five leaders have agreed to have their development banks provide credit to one another. This is banks lending to each other and denominated in their local currencies and not in US dollars. Is that significant?
Yes, it is, because ultimately what may happen later in the year is there'll be a crash in the dollar as people rush away from it because of the deficits that have built up in the US through two things: A, spending too much, mostly on foreign wars, and B, because they've cut the tax base to ribbons over the years to please the wealthy people who fund the political process in the US. So it means that the US is very, very vulnerable now to these big countries getting together and saying, well, we don't need you anymore, we'll trade with each other in our own currencies, so that you will not be able to manipulate the dollar to get what you want on the world stage. So that they're basically giving a clear signal that they're not going to accept that kind of hegemony from the Americans anymore.
They're also making some noises against what's been going on in Libya and saying that these sorts of disputes should be settled peacefully, which is, I wouldn't have thought necessarily that an economics conference was going to come out with a view on Libya.
These things are linked together. I mean, I studied, as did the Prime Minister, political economy at Oxford University, and of course the politics and the economics are linked together. As I said, the decision to take the dollar off gold in 1972 was a political decision. They could have decided to withdraw from Vietnam. They decided not to. They decided to fight on, but they didn't want to raise taxes, so they decided to take the dollar off gold. And at that point, General de Gaulle started saying, well, we want our gold. So he was actually sucking all of the gold out of Fort Knox. And that's why they had to basically close the gold window. But that means that we've actually not had a currency related to gold since 1972, which means basically that all of these currencies have basically become massively overprinted. And this is the root cause of the shock and the crisis that we're going through.
Well, we also had this report from the Royal Commission on Banking this week, Martin, and the four main points, which was, I think it was on Tuesday that it came out. Lloyd's takeover of HBOS should never have happened, we're told. Also, banks will have internal firewalls to protect savers. They'll also have to store more capital to reduce exposure. I suppose that's the chance of crashing. And finally, the bank shares are rising now, actually amid relief at the considered measures. So what do you make of this? I mean, if the bank shares are rising, the banks will be wringing their hands and happy about
it. I think they won't be unhappy about this. It's basically a slap on the wrist.
But is it actually good for the rest of us? Is it good for consumers?
Ultimately, no. The banking system, the root cause of our problems is that the private banking system has imploded. Denial is not just a river in Egypt. People have not faced up to the fact that this is not like a normal crisis where the government's raised interest rates to squeeze out inflation or whatever. We've just had an implosion of a huge bubble that's been built up over 30 years, and we're still not even halfway out of the woods yet.
Peter, what are your thoughts on the way that the cuts are coming in? And you say that they're necessary. Are you absolutely sure about that? Because we're having to suffer here in Bristol, as other people around the country are, as a result of these cuts, aren't we?
Yeah, I think it's how you approach it. I believe that whoever is in government would have had to make cuts. Now, people will, and politicians will decide in different places where the cuts should be. But if we're going to get rid of this debt, and not my granddaughter isn't going to be saddled with it, then I believe, and I think the majority of people I talk to, and we're out on the doorstep at the moment because of electioneering, are saying they'd rather have it short and sharp. And there is, I find, a general support. Nobody wants to lose their job. And, you know, every time you hear on the news another reduction of 150 people to go, you know, it is a burden and quite terrible for those people. But, and I think it is a big but, I think we have to get our finances in straight. And I believe if we'd have gone on then the way that we were going on, then catastrophe would have been even worse. The other problem is we seem to be blaming the banks all the time. I don't necessarily totally blame the banks. I think there was a situation where the government was allowing borrowing and spending to go on at an intolerably high rate, and we were believing that we had this economy that was so sound, so wonderful, that we could go on running up credit card bills into thousands and thousands. It had to come to an end. And if we've stopped it in its tracks and we can get back on a more even keel, I think this blip, and I hope it's a blip, will be worthwhile, and that we'll have some sanity come back into the financial world.
Now, Martin, Peter's right, isn't he? Because the guy you voted for as a Labour activist, Ed Miliband, he also agrees we do need some cuts. Maybe not as much as the coalition are saying.
Well, I think that's what Ed Miliband is saying, although Ed Balls, interestingly enough, started to talk in terms of a new generation of council.
He's the shadow chancellor.
Yeah, he's a shadow chancellor. I think Labour policy at the moment is actually in a bit of a... it's in a bit of a... They've not quite decided
mess.
What it is. Well, I mean, you could say it's
couldn't
a mess.
Help you out.
Well, you can help me out. I mean, actually, you see, the problem is, you see, there's been a whole generation. I used to teach A-level economics, and I studied it at university. And what I would be saying to my A-level students now is watch very carefully what happens here. Because as the government cuts and the economy stutters, it's likely that the deficit is going to go up, not down. Now, this is counterintuitive. This is why we have A-levels, for the high-level students who actually understand what's going on. Ordinary people think that the national economy is like a household, and that if you cut, you know, you've spent more than you've got, then you've got to cut back. That's very, very deeply ingrained in the psychology of ordinary people. But at the higher levels, economists know that that's not the case, and that in actual fact, many conservative leaders of the past were very aware of this. We're making the same mistakes as the 30s. You can't cut your way out of a crash, and that's going to become very, very clear before too long.
What I can't understand, I could accept all that, but I assume that economists and people with qualifications, just like our friend here, were advising the government. So why are these economists now telling the lot that are in 10 Downing Street, do it now, don't let it go on? I mean, for every one set of economists who tells me they're right, I've got another set that's telling me I'm wrong. So I relate it, whether I get criticised or not, to my own experience. Indeed. And my experience was running a successful business. And I know that as soon as my debt got out of hand, I was in trouble. I couldn't run it that way. So I, and my home affairs are exactly the same. And I want us to be back with good housekeeping, borrowing when it's necessary to borrow, for a proper investment in my future and the businesses and the community that I live in. But I don't want us over-borrowing.
Now, I think you'll have to just agree to disagree on that one.
I think we will.
Some different economic schools of thought going on there. Anyway, the NHS is being seen by the majority of the public, the British Medical Association, which represents doctors, and now the Royal College of Nursing too, as a privatisation too far. This is what journalist John Pilger has to say about privatisation.
we must oppose privatising. Privatising is theft. That's all it is. It's theft of public resources, giving it to vested interests so they can profiteer. That's what it means. It doesn't mean anything else. It is stealing what is ours. So the political in me will always oppose that.
That was a guitarist after John Pilger, a journalist there, talking about privatisation as theft. Now, Peter, what do you make of that?
Well, I don't see the current plans as privatisation at all. So we start from a completely different level. I see again that the health service, this marvellous National Health Service that I participate in, have donated to for a very long time and benefited from, does need some improvement. And I think that we have to bring in a new regime. But that doesn't mean privatising it in the sense that the emotive words of privatisation is being used.
Well, the same sort of thing happened to the post office a few years ago, didn't it? The Royal Mail, actually, where it was the idea was to bring in private contractors. And what happened is they ended up cherry-picking all of the easiest jobs to do and leaving the Royal Mail actually losing a tremendous amount of money. It's almost like they were just taking the easy bits, the private people just doing the easy bits, and that is very similar to what's happening here in the health service.
But they did take those easy bits and they've expanded them, created more jobs. They're very, very successful, those bits, aren't they? And therefore, I think we've got to look at within the health service. But, I mean, I see the situation in the practical point of view. I think that if we can control it and properly control it, I think to bring in outside contractors to run certain elements of the health service can be good and can benefit. What I don't want to happen, and which I shall oppose, whichever party brings in, is the denationalisation of the National Health Service. It's something I want run for the benefit of everybody in this country.
But what the British Medical Association, now the Royal College of Nurses too, are saying is that they believe this is the thin end of the wedge.
But they are vested interest, aren't they? I mean, there is real problems with nursing and the way that they've been taken. I don't blame the nurses. My son was in hospital a few years ago with a collapsed lung. In a hospital in Bristol, I went in, my daughter-in-law was there with a minute mop cleaning the floors because it was so dirty. When I went along to the sister, she told me in no unmean terms, cleaning is not my responsibility. Now, where are we going when nurses will allow wards to be dirty?
Now, Martin, actually, it's the Labour Party that started this whole process of marketising the National Health Service.
The case for a national health service hasn't been properly made for a generation. We haven't actually got the best service in Europe, but it's certainly the cheapest. Bulk buying, planning, not competition, is the way forward for things like a national health service. The idea that competition always improves efficiency is simply a fallacy. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And I'm glad to hear that Peter's in favour of a national health service and a nationalised national health service. I think the British people are. And I think to make a political point, what David Cameron said in the run-up to the election was no reorganisations of the health service, and people took him at his word, but basically it was going to be left alone and that the radicalism of the government was going to be pushed in other directions. I think a lot of people out there feel betrayed by the fact that there is a whole policy to discuss.
Is that part of the halt? Sorry? I wonder. But we've got this halt in the bill, haven't we?
Yes.
I got a feeling that the thing just got out of hand. I mean, that the managers, the civil servants who are feeding ministers with all this information.
Well, I think Andrew Lansley himself obviously felt that, you know, he wanted to have a radical reputation.
But it's not just them. It's the private healthcare industry that have been lobbying for many years.
We're talking of vested interests here. I mean, the American healthcare companies are circling above the National Health Service looking to pick off what they can find.
In fact, Andrew Lansley, the health secretary's wife, actually runs a healthcare lobbying company, you know, so there's obviously a few problems. With that, aren't there? Okay, on to our next story, and Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron chose immigration as the topic for a speech this week, which we're told will see Conservatives reconnect with voters in the run-up to the local elections, despite some disagreement from Lib Dem coalition partner and business secretary Vince Cable.
Okay, well, the policy is agreed by the coalition. It is coalition and government policy, and it's being put in place right across the board. And this policy has been agreed by the two parties working together. We obviously had a proper debate about how to get right the visas in terms of for the economy, how to get things right for students in universities, and how to get things right for the family route as well. Coalitions do mean that you have discussions and arguments within your government. We've had those, we've settled the policy, we've agreed it. Now, I've led the Conservative Party for 5 years, and I've addressed this issue of immigration, I think, throughout that time in a very sensible, measured, serious tone, absolutely in line with that. This speech is Liberal Democrat policy. This is coalition policy. This is the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. We came together after the election because no one had clearly won that election. And we sat down and we hammered out a coalition agreement about how we were going to go about some of the big issues facing our country. And on the issue of immigration, where yes, the Conservatives had spoken about this issue a lot in opposition and a serious amount of preparatory work in policy, we did make sure that in that coalition agreement were serious immigration policies that would get our immigration system back under control. Damien Green has done, I think, an excellent job as Immigration Minister making that happen. But we've agreed across government what we're going to do when it comes to universities, what we're going to do when it comes to highly talented migrants who want to come to this country. But the net effect of that is proper immigration control and a significant reduction in the levels of immigration that, frankly, were out of control over the last decade.
That was Prime Minister David Cameron speaking earlier this week and about immigration. Now, Peter Abraham, Conservative councillor here in the studio, could you tell us what you think? Because actually, Vince Cable was saying that he thinks that this could actually inflame disagreements between different ethnic groups, and this might actually be quite an unwise thing to do, he said yesterday.
I think it was Vince Cable who was unwise. I think we have a real problem that every time we talk about immigration, somebody somewhere will shout racist. I think we have to have an intelligent conversation about it. I love Bristol because it's so diverse. I couldn't live in Midsummer, you know, and that's why I'd probably turn off the television when Midsummer Murders come on, because it's all the same, you know, check shirts and caps. I want to live in a city that's vibrant, that has all the mixes in it. But, and I think what David Cameron is pointing to, is that we need to control. We now have, what is it, the Daily Telegraph saying this morning, that 1 in 8 of the population were not born here. I think we need to say what the numbers should be and how we should do it. The point system didn't appear to work and I didn't like it. I actually disagree fundamentally with one element of what David Cameron has said, and that is he says that he doesn't think the cheap labour bit is something in it. I actually believe it's pretty fundamental. I think people will come here because they think they can do better, and I think people will employ them, and we're back where we started in a way about employment in jobs, because they'll take jobs and be paid less. And I think until we start paying proper money to everybody, then I think that will naturally lower some of the people who are coming, particularly from the Eastern European, who want to do better.
So are you saying there are a number of ways
that we can deal with it.
Are you saying then that you think that this is really a sort of big business-led thing where they're actually looking for cheap labour and they've simply put pressure on central government under Labour and Conservative now to allow more migrant labour in?
To me, it looks very much like that. When you look at certain of the communities and that certain people are employing in the health service, in many other areas, and where we are finding it difficult for other people to get jobs because they won't accept it at that level of pay or not worth their while. I don't think one thing will do it, but I think that's a contributory factor, and I think that David Cameron saying he doesn't think it is, I don't accept that.
Now, one of the things that came out in the speech, Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist now, is that between 1997 and 2009, 2.2 million more people came to live in Britain than those who left to live abroad.
Well, if that's the figures, that's the figures. I would just like to say that I agree with what Peter said there about labour costs. I think it's absolutely crucial. I think we're on the doorsteps in labour wards, we get exactly the same response. We need to have a solid minimum wage which everybody gets. And I think about the trade unions in the United States in the early part of the 20th century, where new waves of immigrants were coming in all the time. And each new wave of immigrants was undermining the wages and conditions of the previous lot. And the trade unions simply had to reinvent themselves and change their leaflets into different languages. But the fundamental principle is, and it's a labour principle, you can't have people coming in at less than the rate for the job, whatever it is. That undermines everybody's conditions. And if we had if the labour market was better regulated, we wouldn't have people coming here taking jobs at less than rate, and that would make it a lot easier. And of course, we'd still have the ambitious coming here wanting to work hard, and what would be the problem with that? Because they're going to be contributing, paying taxes. I mean, a lot of the migrants are actually paying taxes in this country.
Absolutely.
Contributing to the health service, even, and then they go back to Poland and they don't even use the health service. So if people are working here, there's no sense in which they're stealing from you. People have got to get their head around that, and I think this has always been a country of, because of the empire and so on, we've had all sorts of different people coming here. Bristol's a great multinational city, and that's part of its success. That's why people invest in it and why people want to come here and visit it.
Can I say there's something else, I believe, on the other end of the spectrum? I think that we are actually, certain people are now earning too much, and therefore I'd like to see that differential. I want people to be high paid, but I think there is a level that I find almost embarrassing. In my own field of local government, that was a public service, and people entered that for public service. Now they are earning more than they do in private sector in a lot of places, but don't have the risk and don't have the sort of pressures that brings in different ways, and they don't have the pensions necessary and the protections that we do in local government. So I think there's got to be a redistribution. I think we've got to bring the bottom up, and who is it to say that person doing what is described now as a lower paid job is not as worthy as the manager in an office in a town hall somewhere?
I'm glad to hear the R word, redistribution, because it's actually what makes a market system work. You have a free for all in one way, and then like a children's party, you make sure that everybody goes home with a present.
I better be careful. I'm agreeing with him.
I think this is important for the future of the country.
Absolutely.
Because if we can find consensus about these things, then it's going to be much more easy to go forward. Because we're never going to have complete equality, but on the other hand, more equal societies, the spirit level. I keep mentioning this book. Marina knows the book I mentioned. Said that the more equal a society is, the happier it tends to be, and that's what the evidence tends to show. And if you think back to the 1950s, when the top rate of tax was 96%, that's because the boys were fighting in Korea, and people knew that some people pay taxes and some people pay with their lives for the country, and there was a sense of shared destiny which came out of World War II, which has dissipated now. People are living in gated communities. They don't think that the people down the road are anything to do with them, and the gap between the rich and the poor has got bigger, and we've got to, you know, I'm glad to hear a Conservative politician saying that that's not good.
Well, I just wonder,
we need to go, we need to look at ways.
I just wonder, both of you, whether this consensus would extend to Westminster, and I somehow doubt it.
Well, that's another question.
One other quote from David Cameron's speech: the number of people in employment increased by 212,000 during 2010, but more than 80% was made up of migrants, according to the Office for National Statistics. Just over 29 million people were in work in Britain during the last quarter of 2010. Now, Marina Morris is joining us, and she's got a piece this week all about obesity. Marina.
Hello. Warren research has shown that almost a quarter of British people, both children and adults, are obese. 10,571 patients were admitted to hospital last year because doctors feared they were so fat that their health was in immediate danger. The number of patients needed urgent treatment because their overweight has increased tenfold in the last decade. Britain is facing an obesity crisis, estimated to be costing the NHS around £4.2 billion a year. The majority is spent treating related illnesses. The cost to the whole economy, including lost productivity, is estimated at around 10 billions pounds. According to the World Health Organization, British people are among the fattest in Europe. The average British person is overweight. But according to research, weight loss surgery amongst young people stop diabetes in more than 4 out of 5 patients, halves excess fat, and saves the cost of surgery within 3 years. A person is classed as obese when their weight has increased to a point where it seriously endangers their health. It is diagnosed when a person's body mass index, or BMI, exceeds 30. BMI is calculated by dividing weight in kilograms by height in meters square. The problem appears to be far more serious among women, who account for 80% of obesity-related hospital admission and operations. However, levels of obesity between the sexes are similar. Experts say this is because women are more self-conscious about their bodies and are likely to press doctors for treatment or surgery to help them slim. But it does not explain why they are 4 times as likely to be admitted to hospital with obesity-related conditions, such as breathing or heart problems, which implies more women are dangerously overweight than men. Whilst genetic factors can play a part, obesity is normally caused by a combination of eating too much or of the wrong types of food, not taking enough exercise, and trying to decrease constant stress and feeling of anxiety by comfort eating. Despite government warnings that we are risking obesity-related illnesses such as heart disease and cancer, our waistlines keep growing. Obesity is one of the new diseases of the 21st century in the developed world, caused by change in how we live. We will win the battle against obesity when we change our poor life-eating habits and reprogram our mind to healthy lifestyle. Our health is in our brains and our hands.
Thanks, Marina. Now, Peter Abraham, Conservative Councillor, what are your thoughts about what you've just heard there? Because we're being told by the World Health Organization that the British are the fattest people in Europe.
Well, they haven't been to the United States. I know that's not in Europe, but they're pretty fat over there, aren't they?
But one of the worrying things that Marina's teased out there in her piece was that actually much of this may be caused by a sort of subconscious anxiety. Now, that's a bit of a worrying one.
Back to my beginning. Be happy. Think thin. That's the slogan of the day. I just get this feeling it's about education. It's eating, I think, the right food. You know, more than, and there seems to be, it's wealth, isn't it? We've talked a lot about how poor we are in many ways, but we're so wealthy compared when I was a child. Chocolate wasn't available. I seen boxes of chocolate, huge boxes of chocolate being handed out before this programme.
I plead guilty.
And none of that was available to us. And I think as kids, we were pretty healthy. I was never hungry.
I think
but we have food. And I think there's just so much now on offer. And I also believe that there seems to be a culture of everything is around food. You know, there seems to be this emphasis. And I think we do need to have perhaps a program of re-educating ourselves in eat sensibly, in moderation. And if people need medical help to achieve that, then it appears from this report that it's probably quite good value for our money being spent on the national health, because we'll save all that money being spent on dealing with them when they have the heart attack, etc., etc.
It's also a very social thing, isn't it, eating with the family or whatever, with friends.
And that doesn't need to stop, does it?
Martin.
Yeah, I mean, in the past, historically, I mean, the poor tended to be thinner and the wealthy tended to be fatter. And what's now clearly the case, the pattern is the opposite way round, because the wealthier have healthier lifestyles for all kinds of reasons. They're happier in general because they're happier in their jobs and so on. And there's an awful lot of comfort eating at the bottom, where people are eating a bag of chips to cheer themselves up because they're fed up about whatever it is. And I think that... again, bringing back the spirit level, the book The Spirit Level by Kate Pickett and Richard Wilson points out, there's a whole chapter on obesity in the book, and they point out that more equal societies, such as Sweden, for example, there's less obesity, everybody's happier and everybody's healthier, if you think of the kind of sporting lifestyle that they have over there. And we're not the same as the Americans, but then we're not as unequal as the Americans. They've gone further down the road to, you know...
Well, that's where we're going, isn't it?
That's where we're going, if we're not careful, yeah.
We are sort of habitualised around eating for obvious reasons, because, I mean, certainly what you were saying, Peter, in the past, you know, food was more scarce, but actually we could do without eating for the day, maybe. Just say one day, well, I'm not actually going to eat anything.
Can I just give an anecdotal question? My father was brought up during the war, and, of course, he had all of the problems with not getting sweets and all the rest of it. And, of course, he is now... overweight, because now he's a you know, he's an elderly gentleman, but he eats too much because he didn't get food as a child. So for him, it's a kind of comfort thing now that even now he has to be stopped from dipping the fat out of after his fried bacon and so on, because when he was a child, that was a treat.
It was.
And it's still a treat in his mind now, where in actual fact it's no good for him.
Well, my advice is try a little bit of mind over a matter and say, I'm not actually going to eat anything today, and see how it goes. Anyway, Marina Morris has been out on the streets again this week asking you if there's a future for the nuclear industry here in the South West, where two nuclear power plants are being planned at Oldbury near Thornbury in Gloucestershire and Hinckley near Bridgewater in Somerset.
Obviously, we need to understand that risks are very high when using nuclear energy, and making sure that the standards of safety are high enough so that such accidents don't happen again.
Personally, I think that the problem in Japan has largely nothing to do with the nuclear industry at all. That's unfortunate that was built in the position that it is, and it was a natural disaster over which the authorities have got no control. Certainly in this country, I think the nuclear industry is so regulated and regulated from the point of view of safety that it's virtually impossible, and especially geologically, we don't have the issues that they've got in Japan. I think those issues are really non-starters.
I think we already knew what the problems were before the accidents.
Under health and safety, our nuclear is much safer than a Japanese one was. Did a lot of shortcuts, and over here would be a much safer condition. I think the early ones weren't very clever, but the latest ones are a lot better. You've got to have power somewhere or the other. They don't run wind turbines. You need a hell of a lot of them to give us a lot of power, which is a nuclear is the only other way, isn't it?
Really?
Not a lot of choice, really.
As long as it's not near us, I think we'll all say.
We do need to think about our protection, yeah. I wouldn't feel very safe.
Are there new jobs for the region? What's the risk?
Possibly. I mean, the jobs are always good for the community, as long as the safety standards are going to be high enough. If not, it's not worth taking the risk, because so many more people will be damaged by the dangers of nuclear energy.
No, I don't think there's any risk. Short answer.
I'm not sure, because you can still get jobs and energy from other sources.
I think it is worth as long as you've got a built-in safety factors in the actual nuclear reactors. That's all you need. As long as you've got built-in safety, fine. I think the new jobs, the way we're going at the moment, we need new jobs. So,
no, I'd say no, they're not. Hopefully we can find jobs in other areas for people.
Is decommissioning a nuclear power station a good use of public money?
At this time, and the kind of money issues that the government's having at the moment, I'd say probably not, and there's a lot of other things that taxpayers' money needs using for, like day-to-day things that affect us every day.
There are risks with it, but there are risks with any form of industry. It's just another type of industry. Risks are well worth it. It's good use of taxpayers' money. Far better than bailing out banks.
You know, I think the taxpayer has funded too many bailouts at the moment. Quite honestly, I think the taxpayer is not getting very good value for money.
No, I just think we should be investing money into better resources, really.
How should we address our future energy needs?
Well, we need to look at what source of energy is going to serve us best in the future, and fuel our our time into looking at that and making sure that that source of energy works for us.
I think we should definitely move towards green energy, windmills and stuff like that. I don't think there's any harm from it, so...
You've got to find an alternative source which doesn't cause too many hazards for the people. We know the wind turbines don't, but a lot of people don't like them too near their homes because they think they're an eyesore, but it swings in roundabouts. You could use the powers of the Severn for a Severn barrage, which would be okay. Then you've got people for that.
There's Marina Morris there out on the streets of Bristol asking you what you think about nuclear power just down the road, new build. Peter Abraham, Conservative Councillor, what do you think about new nuclear build? Are you happy that we may have two nuclear power stations being built just west of here?
I'm not sure the right word is happy in this instance, to be quite honest. It seems to me, and I looked at it as seriously as I can, that it's necessity. I don't know what the future is unless we have an element, and probably quite a large element, of nuclear power. The test now is to make sure that it is as safe as it possibly can be, because we are all concerned. We're seeing what's happening nightly on our television screens, and it's very, very worrying. I content myself that that is an old bit of technology there and we're going to have better. But I presume at the time that that was built, people were telling the people of Japan, this is safe, it's perfectly all right. So I have no nuclear knowledge other than I want the future to have the power to be able to keep us as a nation and a world economically viable. But because without energy, I think it would be a very difficult world to live in.
Now, we don't have tsunamis, really, here in Bristol, or earthquakes so much, but we do have the threat of terrorism. And in 2005, there was a massive terrorist bomb, or several of them, on the London Underground. And surely this is a concern, isn't it? Because however safe you build a reactor, a terrorist is just going to laugh at that when he plants his bomb.
I'm not sure. I mean, I really don't know enough about it. I just hope, and I think we've got to be probably considerably more honest and open. I do worry that many of the meetings, the real knowledge is being held behind closed doors and that things are being kept away. I did spend 1 year as a board member at the old Aubrey power station, and it was quite interesting that the very first job was to sign the Official Secrets Act. Why?
Yes,
as
why?
A public representative, I really felt very bad about that. Because if I heard anything at that meeting, shouldn't I be allowed to come here and sit here and talk about it? That was why I was there, I thought.
So how does that actually affect what you can say about it when you sign the Official Secrets Act? Does that mean that you're not actually allowed to say anything about what's going on in those
meetings? I think if you're told this is confidential information, that's it. You sign it and you're breaking the law if you do it.
And were you confident about the sort of safety regimes that there were at Albury?
Okay. I wasn't on it long enough to get to grips with it. And I felt that I was dealing with total professionals. I really had every confidence in the people that were reporting to us and telling us all about it. And I have one or two friends who were in the nuclear industry. But it is this point of where we've really... As I come back, I feel that we've got to go ahead. It is necessary. What we've got to do is make sure that we are told properly that this is safe and that as many checks are put in as possible to make it safe.
Martin, what about the economics of it? Are these nuclear power stations actually going to be built?
Well, I wrote a paper about this in the 1990s when I worked at the New Economics Foundation. And the fact is that nuclear power has never been adopted under a free market regime. because the then Conservative government wanted to privatise the British nuclear industry. They were talking about, you know, making offerings on the city and so on. And when the private sector analysts looked at it, taking into account the risk of an accident and the insurance costs involved, they said, well, we don't want to touch this. And I think that's pretty much, once you see what's going to happen now as a result of what's happened in Japan, is that the safety premium is going to be massively increased, which is actually going to make it unviable unless it's subsidised.
Well, there's also the fact that the nuclear companies have to deal with all this waste into the future.
Well, that is the main risk.
And decommission the place.
Yes, I know.
Well.
And what we seem to be doing at the moment, a bit like the banks, is we're saying that the privatised nuclear industry can make a profit, can build things, but if it goes wrong, the taxpayer and the government will pick up the tab. That's what will happen in Japan. These are supposedly private nuclear companies, but of course they've long ago run out of resources in dealing with the crisis they're now dealing with, and the Japanese government has had to step in to try and deal with the problem. That's the problem, is that, and we were arguing about this in relation to Eastern Europe, because that's why I was an East European desk officer. Basically, once you've got a nuclear industry, you don't want to just close it down, because you've actually invested lots of salt fixed costs in it. But on the other hand, you don't necessarily want to expand it. And there's going to be plenty of work for nuclear engineers for generations to come dealing with what we've done already. So they don't have to worry about their jobs. There's going to be plenty of jobs dealing with it. I think what we really need to look at is energy conservation. We need to be less greedy in the way we use energy, and a lot of the solutions to our problems lie in designing all of our kit to be super efficient. Now, and that's a technology which everybody can understand.
Now, Peter, one of the things that we've had several people on this programme, not least of which Mike Birkin from Friends of the Earth talking about, is the fact that in Bristol we have a massive tidal reach, which, you know, in a word means mud, really, lots of mud. The tide goes up and down twice a day, a fantastic amount. Have there been any serious attempts in the city to actually generate electricity using the tides?
Yes, they have. I mean, there have been a couple of studies. The last government rejected, if you remember, any sort of investment in that. I think if we have more honesty, and I agree about the cost, then some other schemes would come in to be much more viable than what we appear at the moment. I think we've got to have, perhaps the wrong word to use, but a cocktail of various energies. And I think we still will need those nuclear plants that are being planned at the moment. But I'd like to think that we could reduce, and we must reduce, and we find just better ways of doing things than we are at the moment. We're very, very hungry, aren't we, as far as energy is concerned?
Okay,
we're
Peter,
obese.
Our final, and just a half a obese, crikey, and a half a minute on this one, Peter, just very quickly. The French have banned the burqa. What do you think of that? And two people were arrested on the first day the French banned the burqa. This is the full veil over the face of Muslim women.
I go for total freedom of what people want to wear, but I don't think people who go around wearing the burqa are helping within the integration of a city.
So are you with Jack Straw? You feel threatened by people that wear that?
I don't feel threatened, no. No, of course I don't feel threatened. I think I actually feel a little bit of sadness, because it's lovely from a man's point of view, looking at a very nice lady's face, isn't it? And why should I be denied that?
Martin?
I think I agree with Peter. I mean, in Britain, I saw a Conservative MP on Question Time saying, look, in Britain, we don't have rules about what adults can wear. And that's a rather fundamental principle. Some people have blue hair. I don't like that very much. Some people have bolts through their nose. I don't like that either. But they're entitled to that. If they're over 16 years old, they can wear whatever they like.
Well, thanks to this week's guest, Conservative Councillor for Stoke Bishop, Peter Abraham, and to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, who will be back after the news, when we'll be talking about more about the nuclear power industry. Should it be renamed the cancer industry? That's the view of paediatrician Helen Caldicott, who I spoke to before her talk in the city last night. And also, some people say money's like a drug, and that may not be the only drug some of the top banking dynasties are hooked on. That's coming up after the Sky News at 6 o'clock.
Your voice, and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody